Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Not So Common Podcast for Tuesday, June 12, 2018. I'm Pat Contry. It's in the middle of E3, which I'll be recording a CU podcast with Ian on Thursday, a very special CU podcast. This is actually a re-record. This happens about once a year where I do a recording and think that I'm recording audio and then it ends up that I'm not. So I'm going to be saying a lot of the same things for the second time in this afternoon, but I'm not going to chalk up the fact that I was being, impatient the first time, recording without checking that I was actually recording audio, or carelessness. I'm chalking it up to the 14-10 intermittent fasting I've been speaking about. That's right. You give yourself 10 hours a day to eat, or 8 hours, and then you fast for 14 or 16 hours. And that can mess with your head sometimes. It can throw off your judgment and cloud your ability to cohesively go about a series of actions, like recording a podcast. But here I am. I'm not mad. I'm not mad that I wasted an hour of my time and said some brilliant stuff that I won't be able to repeat. I mean, I had the video of my gums flapping, but no audio to go along with it. But this actually happens like once a year. So this was the one time I'm giving myself. So what's been going on in the world lately? There's been a couple of high-profile suicides that I'll get into. First, there's the unfortunate passing of big-time game collector, preservationist, and curator of the personal computer museum, Sid Bolton. Passed away, I believe, 46 years of age. He leaves behind a wife. I'm not sure what was happening with Sid. I didn't hear about anything wrong medically with him until he unfortunately passed away. And it's a big loss to the not just his community in Ontario, the community around him, which knew him and respected him. He was well known there. It sounded like the Personal Computer Museum was well regarded, according to reviews online. He knew his stuff. I don't know. I'm not the expert on Sid's life. I knew that he authored a couple books. One was the Space Ace and Dragon's Lair collecting book. but I met Sid, I think it was Con Bravo, I want to say about 5 years ago. It was a video game collecting panel, I believe. Either that or video game history. I think it was collecting. And it was myself, Sid, and then it was Billy and Jay, the Game Chasers. And I can't remember if Norm was on there now. That's when I first met Sid. Very nice guy, how everyone has said that about him. And that's the truth. And then I think I might have seen him at one more. Combra. I was probably talking to him for 30 seconds a minute just to catch up the next year or so. But we chatted every now and again on Facebook. Nothing too serious, like maybe like 3 times a year, you know, for a few minutes just saying hi. He sent me a couple of like probably 2 or 3 different suggestions for podcast topics. And then he last got in touch with me at the end of May to tell me about that auction in New Jersey, the live action auction for that person's personal collection. So I didn't get a chance to get back to him, unfortunately. So obviously it's sad. 46 is still pretty young. It's very young in this day and age, especially with the modern technology of, you know, modern medicine. So thoughts to his friends and family. I mean, I knew the guy, but I can't say I knew him that well. I'm not going to pretend I did, just because he passed away. But it's a shame just because there's not a huge amount of people that not only have the will, but also the sizable collection to start a museum or be a curator like Sid was. And I have no idea about how much money he put in on his own, how profitable it was, or it probably was a nonprofit, I'm guessing, but you still need money to run it. So hopefully someone follows in his footsteps and could carry on the mantle of doing important work in terms of game preservation. And in this case, this personal computer museum. And he had a huge game collection as well. I think he was known as being one of the larger, if not largest, video game collectors in Canada. So they'll get to a point where I guess we'll find out what will happen to his huge game collection, whether it's pieced out, someone takes it over, maybe a museum starts with that. But my concerns right now, obviously, his friends and his family have to deal with this awful loss. But then someone's going to have to do something about that museum. What happens to the museum? Not a lot of us out there. There's not a lot out there that, like I said, have the money, means, will to do like a museum dedicated to this stuff. There's not that many of them. So hopefully there's a support group that rises up that helps out there. But here's to you, Sid. Important person in the community. Did good work. Good guy. Was always nice to me in our interactions. And best to the surviving friends and family there. NBA Finals came and gone. The NBA Finals. I thought the Warriors would have a chance to sweep just because I think they didn't want a repeat of last year against the Cavs, where game four they got blown out and then finished up in game five. I think they wanted they knew their foot was on the neck of the Cavs and they really wanted to crush them. And they did. It was a laughable game four closeout game where it was garbage time with like 4 minutes left in the fourth quarter. All the starters came off. That's unheard of to me, not just in an NBA Finals game, but for a closeout game, for a potential winning game, where the game is so far gone, you're just going to pull everyone. It comes out afterwards, though. LeBron James, he shows up at the press conference after game four. He's got a soft cast on his hand. And he says, yeah, you know, I've been playing the last few games with a broken hand. I punched a whiteboard after the game one loss. So he was playing with a compromised hand, and the evidence shows that his hand was puffy on close-up pictures. But then also you look at his stats for outside shooting in games 2, 3, and 4, the numbers just decline in terms of even attempts from the field. I think the first game he had like 16 attempts, and then like games 2, 3, and 4, by the time he got to games 3 and 4, it was like a few attempts each game on average. That's it from outside, I think, of like 10 feet, so basically outside of a driving sort of lane location. And he was doing a lot of driving. He still played not great. He played good games in games 2, 3, and 4. You can argue great for a couple of those, but game 4 was just sloppy, and they gave up. The Cavaliers gave up that game. Like they just didn't try. They didn't have a heart. So, of course, you get to the conversation. Well, first off, hats off to the Warriors. They won 3 out of 4. If not for the combination of Stephen Curry being compromised in 2016 from his MCL sprain, and the fact that Draymond Green gets suspended game 5, and the fact that Iguodala was hurt, and I think one other player was hurt on the Warriors. The Warriors should have won four titles in a row, which would have put them in the pantheon of all-time great teams. They are anyway, but I mean that hasn't been done since the 60s, where team wins like 4 in a row. You know, it was like the old Celtics teams, I guess, did that way back when. Oh, with Bill Russell, did his teams win 4 in a row? I'll look that up later. I might be wrong. But they went. But Russell won like 11 of them, though. So he must have won 4 in a row or close to it at some point to get 11 titles. That's insane. Then again, there was like only 8 or 10 teams then, but still. So it's a great accomplishment. But the conversation always comes back to, you know, is LeBron the greatest of all time? Because he strapped his team to his back. He's been to the NBA Finals 8 straight years. Then again, it's in a very weak Eastern Conference compared to Western Conference. We get that. But still, 8 in a row, getting there is fine. You know, he's only won those 8 years. He won 3 when he went 3 and 5. And you could have said he went 1 and 7. You could have said, because 2 were really, He didn't win. He only won 1 of those 3 decisively. The other 2 were skin of their teeth types, you know. Game 7 than the other 2. Anyway, so the greatest of all time. To me, that doesn't mean you're a great player, because LeBron is absolutely one of, if not the best players of the past, you know, 15 years. That's fine. But being a great player means you also have to be a great leader, especially if you want to be a champion. You have to keep together a core team. You have to not upset the apple cart. You have to massage different egos and personalities and not piss off people. Maybe not trade away a great player like chase away a great player like Kyrie Irving, who demanded to be traded after he didn't want to be in LeBron's shadow and feel like he was being disrespected. You go back to that, some shots from the 2017 season where he's zoned out in a huddle. LeBron's yelling at him. You can see Kyrie's eyes. He's just gone. He just can't wait to get the fuck out. He couldn't stand LeBron. But he helped LeBron win that championship. He hit that game-winning shot, Game 7 in 2016. So when you talk about Michael Jordan in terms of he was a great player, but he managed to make the best of all other players around him. And that's something Kobe Bryant even said. He said getting the most out of players isn't just throwing the ball at them when you pass to them. You have to like manage these people. You have to bring out the best in them throughout the season, keep them motivated. And that's, I think, not what LeBron James' strength is. So I think historically he's going to go down as a great player, one of the best. There's no way he's going to be considered the top player years from now. No way. Because if so, he would have been able to attract more players to him and then keep those players around, and that's never been how he's been. I think he rubs people the wrong way. I think he's a bit abrasive, but he walks around like he knows he's the best. He has Chosen One tattooed on himself. I go back to that because that just shows you the ego involved here. Jordan didn't have to tattoo himself saying he was the best. He just proved he was the best on the court. And I know that because he destroyed my freaking should have been champion New York Knicks, you know, every freaking year in the Eastern Conference Finals. Like Jordan defeated so many Hall of Famers every year. It was insane. I would think we forget about that too, how stacked some of those teams were in terms of, or overall, a huge chunk of those teams, of the good teams, had at least one Hall of Famer on them. It Stockton Malone, you had Charles Barkley on the Suns, you had Ewing on the Knicks, you had Dominique Wilkins on the Hawks. You had Magic Johnson, obviously you had Larry Bird, you had Isaiah Thomas on the Pistons. So you had a plethora of teams that had Hall of Fame caliber player or players. Stockton Malone are probably the most famous one in their primes that were, you know, the 1-2 punch. And by the way, Jordan beat them 2 years in a row, which I was pissed. I wanted Stockton Malone to win one. Little plucky John Stockton, best point guard ever, by the way. Jordan just went out and just did it. And you can say, yeah, well, maybe his numbers weren't as good as LeBron here and there. Historically, doesn't matter. He kept the team together, and he was a leader on that team, and he led by example. And they rub people the wrong way where LeBron comes out with a cast at their game 4 and not games 2 or 3. And then I guess you don't want to expose the weakness, but this looks like it's a weak sauce move, though, to be like, oh, this is my cast. This is why I have a built-in excuse for losing this finals. Where he should have just let someone else say, yeah, it turns out like a week later, keep it mum. Like, yeah, LeBron didn't want to make excuses, but he broke his own hand in game 1, and that's why we didn't have a shot. And good leaders wouldn't do something like that. A good leader wouldn't get so frustrated. I understand a game 1 loss is huge, especially at Golden State when you're expected not to win anything. And by the way, it doesn't matter. If they won game 1, the Cavs weren't going to win the series. It was over in 5 or 6 if they win game 1. I think I picked them the Warriors to win 5. Anyway, it was going to be a wrap no matter what. It just depends on at what point was it going to happen. But LeBron hastened that by punching his hand in anger, and that's something that I don't think a true GOAT or greatest of all time would do to themselves. That's just ridiculous. You're playing yourself out of the series by doing something like that. So. Here's the Curry, Durant, that dummy Draymond Green, that temporary Draymond Green, and goofy, lovable Klay Thompson for 3 out of 4. And they can get another one next year unless LeBron has his Banana Boat Crew all team up with him and Chris Paul and Melo and Dwayne Wade. You guys ever see that the Banana Boat picture? That's why they're called the Banana Boat Crew. They vacationed together a few years ago and got on one of those inflatable banana boats. It was pretty funny. What else is going on? There's been a couple of high-profile deaths, unfortunately. Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade. Anthony Bourdain is more well-known than Kate Spade, but Kate Spade was a businesswoman. She created her own little fashion empire. And she committed suicide at 55 years old, 55, 56. And then a few days later, the more known Anthony Bourdain, who was a famous chef, and then rose to superstardom with his Parts Unknown series on CNN, travelogue and food show, where he goes around the world, he meets and talks to the locals, and then you know, they make food with them, and he learns about the culture and about the food. And it's a great series. I used to watch it on CNN. I believe it's off of Netflix later this month. So if you have not seen Parts Unknown with Anthony Bourdain, you should watch a few episodes. And I remember I retweeted that it was a unique show, is because it was one of the only shows I knew about that showed that tried to bridge the gap between cultures, between America and the rest of the world. There's not a lot of shows, at least popular ones that I know of, that did that, where an American would go out and learn from other cultures and talk to other peoples and, you know, learn their ways and eat their food. And you know, there's some fun parts of that, some intimate moments, and there's some interesting things that happen. I saw one where I think they went one, I forget where he went, they dug up somewhere in South America or the Philippines, where they dug up tarantulas and then roasted them and ate them. They like roasted the tarantulas on a kind of spit, I think, and then chomp on them. Hey, maybe it tastes good. It must to them. And it tried to get past the whole stereotype of Americans being boorish, you know, isolated, just egocentric people. And I think we do get a bad rap when it comes to that. I think some of it is justified, but I don't think it's all our fault, just because when you look at the world map, we got two huge oceans on the west and the east of the U.S. So it's not like you can easily travel to other cultures. If you live in Europe or around the Mediterranean or in Asia, it's a lot easier to get on a boat or a cheap plane fare or a cheap train, and just go to another country and experience totally different food, a different language, different people. I mean, I can do that in San Diego, but that's it. It's a very small part of the U.S. where you can even go just to Mexico. And yeah, you can go to Canada, but that's not really that. I mean, it's a little bit different, but not that much. But the average American can't travel to experience another culture easily. So I'm not going to put it all on us and our ignorance. I'm putting it just on geographics of where we live. I can't easily just say, or the average American can say, yeah, I'm just going to go to Thailand and watch a kickboxing match and visit a Buddhist temple and experience a nice curry. Okay, you got like $2,000 on you to make that happen? Not the average American doesn't. The average American has enough money, maybe to make it to Disneyland every couple of years. Maybe to drive to Florida. Maybe to go to Busch Gardens in Virginia. That's about it. That's about all we got in us. You know, that's really it. So Anthony Bourdain, he commits suicide. I think he hanged himself. That's the reports. I listened to Joe Rogan speak about Anthony Bourdain just because he was a friends with him. I didn't know Anthony Bourdain did jujitsu almost every day. Did not know that. But I think I got a tweet from someone, or someone asking about commenting on what I thought about this, about why, you know, why are these celebrities killing themselves? And I guess my response would be, I guess I take it for granted. I guess the understanding of how we fragile animals operate. But the best answer I can say about why a celebrity would kill themselves is the same reason why anyone else would kill themselves. And because we are all the same. We're the same people. Average people, celebrities, we all are, our minds are so similar. Our experiences are so similar. We have the same emotional range. Whether you're poor, middle class, of course, the emotional range is exactly the same. We're all cut from the same cloth. We all have the same just fragile combination of neurons firing and chemical interactions in our head. That pile of mush, that's our brain, that forms our thoughts, our opinions, that manages our personality, forms our personality and our mood. It's all the same. So the level of fame or celebrity status or occupation doesn't change what we feel. A rich person, a person like Anthony Bourdain, or someone that's experiencing going around the world having so much fun, he still suffered from anxiety and depression, apparently. Someone like Kate Spade suffered from depression, looks like. Doesn't matter that she, you know, had her own business, had lots of money, had her own fashion empire that she formed. Well, a lot of times driven people are the least calm in terms of their mood and their psyche. Look at Steve Jobs was not known as a happy person, and he was most driven, always looking forward, always saying what's next. I'm not saying there's a correlation between being driven and having anxiety or depression. I'm just saying that there might be a tinge of unhealthiness that's inside the most driven people. I mean, people ask me sometimes about, I think Ian was quoted for the Wired article about him, I don't know how he has fun anymore. That's my friend saying that about me. It's because sometimes when you're so blinded by projects in front of you and what's next, what's over the horizon, you're constantly running. You can't just stand still and relax for a second and think about, okay, let's enjoy life. Let's smile. And yes, everyone needs a balance between work life and relaxation, of course. But I'm just saying the overall general person that is maybe really, really driven, and I can say I'm a driven person based upon, you know, sort of measuring my level of ambition versus other people I know. I can definitely say I'm more driven than not. And this isn't making it about me, but I do know that at least for myself, sometimes I don't enjoy life as much as I should. I don't take a step back. I'm either working too hard or just not working smart enough. I'm just burnt out. I mean, I've been burnt out for a while. So the point is this, if that's with me, someone with a huge business like Kate Spade, they might be in that boat, but just amped up where they're always thinking about what's next. How's my business doing? I think Kate Spade sold stock in her original business and then formed a new business even. So she was still in that mindset of let's build something. Let's do this. It takes a very special type of person to do that. It takes a lot of energy. But yeah, you're sacrificing a lot when you're that sort of person. You're sacrificing the ability to relax as much as you'd like. When you work for yourself and you have your own business, you're working a lot. It's very stressful. That's not to say that any other type of job isn't stressful. I worked 55 hours a week at one point, office job, and that was stressful. But the person that drives himself to that point might be susceptible to some of this stuff, of not being happy. Or maybe they're constantly running towards something because they're trying to escape a feeling of standing still. And that can be part of it too. There could be an anxiety behind not being able to enjoy life and just sit back and just stand still. And that could be part of it too. I read a story from a link about there's been like a 30% increase in suicides in the past 20 years, especially in middle-aged people. It's like 45 to 64, something like that, which is where these two folks happen to fall into, Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade. And it's not surprising. Now, we are more diagnosed than ever before when it comes to mental health, which is good. There's less and less of a stigma. But that doesn't mean we're diagnosed correctly or that we're prescribed the right drugs when we go for depression or anxiety. I mean, mental health is still evolving and we're still trying to play catch up. I mean, psychiatry is only 100 years old. It's in its infancy. I mean, medicine in terms of the body is like, that's thousands of years old. We have developed thousands of years of knowing how to cure broken bones and heart disease and fixing teeth and brain surgery. I mean, the ancient Egyptians were doing some of that stuff, for God's sake. But when it comes to mental health, it's not like putting a splint on an arm or a leg. It's a little different. It's a little dicier. So you can go to, the difference is this, you can go to like a world-class surgeon and they'll have the same, like two people with a broken leg can go to the same world-class doctor and get fixed up. And they'll splint it the same way, it'll reset the bone, and you're both fine as long as you follow what the doctor prescribed. Maybe not the same exact time frame, depending on your individual bodies, but you're both going to be able to walk. You're both going to be fine. You'll be stronger than before. Two people that have depression or anxiety go to the same world-class psychiatrist, exhibit the same symptoms, are diagnosed with something similar, and then are prescribed something similar. Person A could take that prescription medicine and be totally fine and on their way and functional say within a couple months. Person B could either have no effect, might make it worse. Because what's in those pills, those chemicals affect us differently. Because we're talking unexact science here. Talk to someone you know that has deal with mental health issues, been prescribed medicine. It's a struggle. Sometimes you go on something, it gets worse. You got to try something else, or you try a combination of drugs. And that can go horribly wrong for some people. I mean, when you watch some of these commercials for like Paxil or anything else, when you look at some of these like antidepressant or anti-anxiety medications, I mean, hell, potential side effects, sometimes they say like suicidal thoughts for some of these. It says it right on the TV. Like they have to, by law, say what's the potential side effects. I'm not saying that's what necessarily happened with someone like Anthony Bourdain, but who knows? And this is a person, Anthony Bourdain, that still, according to Joe Rogan, was like a heavy drinker and used to be a drug addict. Used to do heroin. So he's already had a susceptible, I think, personality for some of this darkness. And I believe from something I read, after his marriage went kaput, he did have suicidal thoughts after that. So just not a good recipe for all these things thrown together. And I have no idea what his relationship was with his current girlfriend. I have no idea. There's some rumors that maybe that was going south. He told Joe Rogan that this was the happiest I felt. I've never been happier. I think that's what that quote was. And that's very telling as well, because if you're someone who said and meant that I've never been happier, you're a person of very, very highs and very, very lows, most likely. Most people are more even keel. We have like smaller peaks and valleys. But if you say I've never been happier, you're on your highest high. But it also means that you can crash and be on a very low low in that valley. And that's probably what happened to him. He had a peak. He dipped into one of those valleys, dipped right into a deep depression. And it's unfortunate. Sounds like, you know, he was a good guy. Demons aside, his personal demons. And he had a good show. Peabody Award-winning show. Go watch it on Netflix. Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown. Go check it out. Learn something about other cultures. It's fascinating. The food, the customs, the dress, everything. I haven't watched one in years. I used to catch it on CNN every once in a while. And I just sort of fell off of cable news in general, because cable news is a wasteland for the most part, all of them. But yeah, it's sad. It's always sad when someone decides to end their own life. You don't know why. I think Kate Spade left a note to her daughter. I can't imagine having a kid and doing it. I know you can't blame someone who does this, but wow. I'm just putting myself in a picture. If I have a daughter or son that I love, whew, man, that's, you got to be hurting to do that. I mean, it's out of your hands almost at that point. If you have loved ones, you know you're leaving behind, you know they're going to be hurt, but you just can't handle it anymore. You can't face it. And that's why you can't blame people that do this. I mean, I've known people that I've spoken about and people that I haven't spoken about publicly that committed suicide. And it's hard. I know it's okay to feel angry about it. That's natural. But it's hard. I mean, the person going through so much pain to do that, man, that's rough. That's rough to have that pain enough to just wipe it all out. I just want to go to darkness. I don't want to exist anymore. I just want my existence to end. And that would be better than what I'm feeling right now. To get to that mindset, that takes a lot. That's not just like breaking up with a boyfriend and girlfriend. That's something a lot deeper than that. That has to be intrinsically linked to your overall mood and personality over a long period of time. It's rough. This Not So Common podcast is sponsored by NordVPN. It's what I use to keep myself safe online, and you can too. If you care about your privacy and the security of your information, NordVPN is giving you guys 77% off a 3-year plan when you go to nordvpn.com/pat or use code PAT at checkout. VPN stands for Virtual Private Network, and today having a VPN is more critical than ever. Why? If you're doing anything online, your information and browsing habits are out there for anyone to get a hold of. Internet service providers can track our every move and use our private information to their benefit, not ours, selling our browsing habits and even slowing down the websites we all visit. When you use NordVPN, you have access to over 4,000 super speedy servers in 62 countries. And those connections secure your information using military-grade encryption. That means your information and what you do online is nearly impossible to track. I'm using the NordVPN app on my phone and laptop, so that means when I'm getting free Wi-Fi at the coffee shop or at the airports or hotels that I go to, I know things like my passwords and banking info are masked. Don't just listen to me. The folks at PC Mag gave NordVPN their editor's top VPN choice. One account lets you protect up to six devices with one account. There's an app for Android and iOS. You get unlimited bandwidth, and there's a money-back guarantee if you're not satisfied. Quick aside here, I've been hopping on servers around the world, as NordVPN lets me do. There's a few other benefits I've been testing out, mainly accessing streaming services in other countries, and also been checking out a theory I heard about that might help you get a little bit better price on airfare. Keep you posted there. Again, to get that special offer, which breaks down to only $2.75 per month, go to nordvpn.com/Pat or use code Pat, P-A-T, and get going with your secure web browsing. Let's talk about CM Punk living his dream. Living the dream. You know, first of all, I'll say this. We all knew that CM Punk was going to get destroyed in his second UFC fight, even though he was fighting someone else that was also 0-1 against the same opponent, Mickey Gall. But he chased the truth. He fought the truth, Mike Jackson, who is an MMA, I believe an MMA reporter, had some light boxing experience. And it showed because he boxed the shit out of CM Punk's face. CM Punk had to go to the hospital. May have broken his nose. I don't know what else. But it was a bloody fight. Mike Jackson carried him the three rounds. Mike Jackson clowned around. I mean, Dana White was so pissed about Mike Jackson that he said he's never going to fight here again. Because Mike Jackson could have ended that fight in the second round. Definitely the third round he could have ended the fight. He absolutely could have. But he was clowning around. He denies he was doing it. He was. Which is not good for the sport because it's even more disrespectful to martial arts. On top of a professional fight that had no right to even exist on a UFC main event card or main card, but you don't give an opponent an opportunity to come back, because all you need is one punch and you could be over. I mean, I look back at he wasn't showboating, but Chael Sonnen got caught the last 30 seconds of his fight against Silva for the title, five, 6 years ago. Got caught, and he was winning in the fifth round on all the judges' scorecards. He was going to be a champion, and then he got triangle choked in the last 30 seconds. And that was it. So you don't give your opponent an opportunity to hang around if you can finish it. And you should have just knocked them out, and that would have been best for everyone. But he didn't. CM Punk loses. That should be the end of his it's definitely the end of his UFC career. I hope it's the end of his mixed martial arts career as well in terms of competition. Now, I tweeted that since I saw some wrestlers try to, I guess it's the community of wrestlers, the brethren, saying, oh, CM Punk lived his dream, and she's proud of him. And I don't understand why everyone's giving CM Punk a participation trophy, a paid participation trophy, by the way. CM Punk is getting, he signed a three-fight, $1.5 million contract with UFC. So $500,000 a fight, win or lose, plus he's probably getting a percentage of the pay-per-view buy rate. So who knows? That can be between $500,000 and $1 million. I have no idea. It's a fucking ton of money. That's more than 99% of any mixed martial artist will ever make professionally fighting. The undercard people, you start out in the UFC, you're making 25 grand a fight? That's what I read from a couple years back. 25 grand a fight or 30 grand? And you get a bonus if you win. And then you take out all the training fee and everything else, and these fighters aren't making anything to get their asses kicked. So I think it's a combination of mixed martial artists and professional fighters being so annoyed that not just that CM Punk skipped the line and now have to go through the grueling years and several years of being on the indie circuit, I guess, or the regional pro fighting circuit, and paying your dues as if it's pro wrestling, and working your way up with opponents of your own stature, and then grinding, and then getting to the spot. Not just that, But it's the fact that he's getting paid more than them. I think if he got rid of one or the other, I think most people wouldn't have a problem. If he wasn't paid anything and got his ass kicked, I wouldn't have as much of a problem on it. If he got the same salary as everyone else, you could say, well, Pat, that's what UFC want to pay him. And that's fine. They're dumb for doing that because it's not, I don't think the revenue that they got is worth people looking at it like a joke. I think in the long run, I think that hurts them. I don't care if they made a couple $100,000 more in the first pay-per-view or, you know, for the second pay-per-view with this fight, I don't think they made anything more. Because at that point, who wants to watch him a second time get his ass kicked? No one's going to want to watch him a third time, but even the second time. So CM Punk gets destroyed, and everyone says he's living his dream. He's not living his dream, because this is not the same path anyone else would have had to the UFC. And before you say Brock Lesnar, Brock Lesnar is a totally different story. Brock Lesnar, first of all, didn't have his first fight in the UFC. It was elsewhere, his first professional fight. Second of all, Brock Lesnar is a world-class athlete, freak of nature, was a lot younger than the 37 or 38 years old CM Punk was when he had his first fight. Third, Brock Lesnar was a world-class NCAA champion. Like, he was a champion wrestler in college. And that transfers over to being directly into being a mixed martial artist. There's a lot of guys that come out of amateur wrestling and become very successful mixed martial artists. So those three things Lesnar had going for him. And again, he proved himself at least in one fight before jumping to the UFC. And he proved himself over the long run by being a champion, as a heavyweight champion as well, even though it was not exactly a stacked division when Lesnar was fighting as a heavyweight. But he went, I think, 6-3 as a fighter. So Lesnar is a totally different story. Totally different. But no, this was not a dream. The dream would have been grinding it out, fighting for one of the dozens of regional mixed martial arts promotions throughout the U.S., I think there's at least a couple dozen in the U.S., and there's dozens in the world that he could have went to and gotten paid. Not nothing. Not saying the guy's got to get paid nothing, but at least prove yourself to commensurate talent to then eventually work up to the UFC over some years, or even Bellator, which is like the second biggest one in the world, mixed martial arts promotion. That would be, quote-unquote, the dream to me. To me. Because to me, when you say living his dream, whew. Now, this was fantasy, buddy. This was a fantasy that CM Punk achieved. This is something that should not exist. It's not a dream. Dream is that kid that starts at 5 years old taking Taekwondo, works his way up for 25 years. Hard work, training every day, making nothing. And then finally, you know, coming into the UFC and then saying, oh, wow, this was all that hard work paid off for. I've proved myself as a martial artist and as a fighter. That's the dream. This was a gifted opportunity that made Punk over $1 million over the two fights. This was a fantasy. Don't let anyone tell you different. This was a fantasy. That should never have happened. This would have been unreachable without this gift from Dana White in the UFC. And I guarantee you, if this was if they had to do this over again, there's no way in hell they would have done this over again. There's no way in hell. It was impetuous. Punk was the hottest wrestler at the time when he quit WWE back 4 or 5 years ago. There's no way they would repeat this. And Punk, I watched the fight. Punk looked like an amateur still. You can call him professional. He was an amateur. Sorry. He should have. The problem, though, is that even facing someone 0-1 at a quote-unquote UFC-style level, he still got destroyed. So there'd be no one they could have found to fight Punk that would have been someone that would not be able to destroy him, but at the same time would be on the same level that would be entertaining enough not to be laughed off a UFC card, even as a non-televised or non-pay-per-view fight. You would have to have found someone that started training within a year or two, someone that's at some random gym, or someone from the crowd that may have been familiar with mixed martial arts just by watching it and knows how to throw a couple punches and maybe a couple leg kicks and maybe knows how to not get choked out immediately. then you would have a fair fight, but that would have no place being on a UFC card. That would have a place on the freaking Idaho a fighting ring event out in someone's barn. Like that, then that's fine, making $50. And that's where Punk should have started. At least that's where he should have tried to cut his teeth. I'm not saying you do that forever, but do a few fights over a year. Even still do the same hard training, the same world-class training partners and coaches, but then just it was not a good idea. I think Dana White and other people agree. It was not a good idea. It wasn't worth whatever pittance money UFC made off it in the grand scheme of things. They don't need that money versus the integrity of their sport. They don't. So to me, it was equivalent of a fantasy camp thing where I see in commercials on WORTV for like, oh, hang out with Keith Hernandez and other Mets players past their prime or retired this weekend or this, you know, you spend like 3-4 days playing, doing drills with old Mets players on a field. All these like these weekend warriors and 45-year-old businessmen going out there and pretending they're real baseball players, learning from, you know, from these former professionals. The only difference is in that scenario, those businessmen and people that weren't professionals were paying to have that experience. CM Punk was getting paid handsomely for the fantasy. And that's the difference. And that's not to wish ill will on the guy. I don't take pleasure in seeing him get beat up a couple times. That's just calling it like it is. It was a fantasy. He didn't live a dream. These days, you can get practically everything you want on demand, including this podcast. You can listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. Did you know also you can get postage on demand? You can. All you need is stamps.com. With stamps.com, you can get access to all the services of the post office right from your desk. You can buy and print real U.S. postage for any letter or any package. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just click, print, and mail, and you're done. You just need a printer, but also need a digital scale. And stamps.com will provide you one. You can weigh your letters and packages and print the exact amount of postage every time. I've been using stamps.com for probably 5-6 years at this point, mailing out NES Punk DVDs, wristbands, CU Podcast pins, even some random consoles I've sold in the past. I've had extra Sega CD. Yeah, I sold a couple of those in the past as well. Right now, you can use code NSC for a special offer. You go to stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top, and you type in NSC. You get a 4-week trial that includes postage and a digital scale sent right to you. Again, go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top, enter code NSC for your 4-week trial, including postage and a digital scale. And get mail and get shipping. It's the most convenient, easiest way to do so with stamps.com. All right. We got a little Q&A time with the Not So Common podcast here. This is from at Griffin Acuna. Acuna Matata. Hey, Pat, can you talk about your plans for the summer? Also, what did you used to do in the summer when you were a kid? Oh, God. First of all, my plans for the summer. I will be finishing, hopefully, or working on a certain Super Nintendo guidebook. I'll be at Too Many Games, June 22nd to 24th. I will also be getting Castle Contra in order. I'm redoing the backyard here so I can actually have a party with a grill out there. That'd be fun. Get the trees cut because the people before lived here before me didn't have any good upkeep of anything here. That's what's going on here in my life for the summer. Maybe I'll get a tan. Maybe I'll get into better shape. The intermittent fasting is working so far. As a kid, I did a lot in the summer. I ran around. Chubby Pat ran around. Even though I ate too much chocolate chip cookies, but we played wiffle ball, street hockey a little bit in the summer, even though that was mainly in the fall and winter. Street tennis, real tennis on a tennis court too. Basketball at the park. We'd play manhunt. We played football every now and then, even though mainly again the fall. We ride our bikes. Water fights with water balloons and the super soakers and all that. We would play freeze tag. We had something called poison bottle, which was our neighborhood form of freeze tag. I don't know where that came from, by the way, that game. What else? Little Jimmy truck would come around. We'd get beg our parents 50 cents for a little rainbow Little Jimmy Italian ice, which was I would do blueberry and cherry, or blueberry, cherry, and lemon. That's the combo you want right there. Yeah, we played video games, but we ran around the house a lot or hang out with friends. We'd ride our bikes. We'd go to the woods, hang out in the woods. There wasn't forest porn there yet. We're too young for that. But we would do that. We'd run around, have fun, go to our friends' houses. We played Nintendo, but we got around. We exercised. Days before the smartphone. Little League, I did baseball. Little League would run until about July, I believe, early July. It was like April to early July, or late June at least. We would do like the local county fair. We would do that. And we'd go to Seaside Heights. We would do Seaside Heights a few times a summer. We'd do a couple separate weeks. And then we would do like a couple like weekend trips or day trips. We'd get down there. It wasn't too far. And that's what we did. And it was a blast. Now, it wasn't all fun and games in terms of the apprehension of school coming again, because like June was the best month ever, because June was like, okay, we're just out of school. We got the whole summer ahead of us. We can just be just goofs and goof off the whole summer. Once you got to July, like the middle of July, with lightning bugs and or fireflies, whatever you want to call them. Once you got the middle of July and July 4th, now you're knee deep into summer. Now we're here. Now it's half over. Now you're 6 weeks away from school. Now it's starting to feel not like it's still summer, but now you're like, okay, this isn't as fun as it was in June. Once you hit August, the fun time was over. Once you hit August, you had constant reminders of school coming, whether it was commercials for fucking Trapper Keepers and JCPenney sales on school clothes and new jeans that your mom would drag you to. The Sunday circulars that would have advertisements for those like Mead zebra colored notebooks and pencil cases and racers. So you got back by early August. You're already getting back into summer's over. Get back to school. Let's buy all your stupid school supplies for the upcoming awful school year. And that's why August is still my least favorite month of the year. Even today, when it gets to August, I feel weird the whole month of August. I hate it. Because it always reminds me of impending doom is August. And don't get me started on those stupid Disney afternoon commercials that would run. It's getting closer. It's only 3 weeks away. Guess what? That means school is 3 weeks away, or sometimes less. It means it was 2 weeks away. The new Disney afternoon lineup was exciting, but it sucked because that meant it was a new school year for those 5 or 6 Disney afternoons that I experienced as a child from like whatever it was, 8 to 13. So that's what I did during the summer. Fun times, the good old summer. But no, I made the most of it. It was great. You would like play until 8 o'clock at night because the sun would go down at like 8 o'clock after the summer solstice. So you can stay out late, run around, have your mom yell, Patrick, it's time to come in. Oh, no, Mom. But I can go home and watch Unsolved Mysteries and not be able to fall asleep because I was too scared. All right, this is from at Harvey Farrier. Seeing you're from New Jersey, can you comment on Action Park? There's a movie by the Jackass crew coming out about it. Well, the movie's called Action Point, and Johnny Knoxville is the star and I think director, but at least the star or guy behind it, because it's all supposed to be all real stunts. If you see the trailer, it looks like real stunts. He got screwed up, Johnny Knoxville. I think he broke a rib. His eyeball popped out. I think he like hit his head and got a couple concussions. Yeah, he's 46. Even his wife's saying, what are you doing? Still doing this stuff. So Action Point's a movie. It's based upon Action Park. And it's really heavily inspired. They have all the same rides and the rope swing in the movie trailer. They have the alpine sled thing where it's like a concrete sledding tunnel and you're on a little, can you call it sled? It's like a sit-up piece of plastic board with wheels on it and you can go flying at any time. And people did get hurt in it. They got like freaking burns. They got road rash from the alpine sled at Action Park. But there was a big water park in New Jersey I never went to it. I was too young. I probably would have been killed if I went. But there were some there was some stuff like the, I think it was called the Cannonball Loop, which was a something of legend until people found old pictures of it, and then someone actually got a video of it. It was a water slide that went into a 360 loop. Yeah, that sounded safe. That reportedly, people would get stuck on the top because there wasn't enough momentum to get around, and they had to it barely stayed functional. So people died at this water park. And at this, it was a water park entirely, but it was largely a water park. But people died. People were electrocuted in the wave pool. People, I think, hit their head in there's like a rapids area. People got hurt on the alpine sled. I knew someone in the neighborhood that came back with a burn on their arm from the road rash from this cement freaking track of the alpine sled. I think they had little mini carts as well, race cars. Action Park's a trip. It's deserving of the reputation it had. It was dangerous. There was multiple people killed there in the 80s. Multiple people. And I think it closed in the mid to late 90s. It closed September 2nd, 1996. It started in the late 70s. Other notable water attractions. The Tidal Wave Pool. Yep, people died there. They had the rapids, Roaring Rapids. Yep, people died there. The Tarzan Swing. People got hurt. They had the Aqua Scoot, really. The Super Speed Water Slides, that sounds safe. Today it is known as the H2O No. That's right, someone bought Action Park and reopened, I think, the past 10 years. They had diving cliffs. They had diving cliffs. You dove off of cliffs at this water park. These are things that I don't understand how it was legal back then. Let's see. Diving cliffs. Former employee Tom Ferger says the bottom of the pool of the diving cliffs was eventually painted white to make it easier to spot any bodies on the bottom. Holy shit. The large pool into which people jumped is no longer used for regular swimming, only to deposit used tubes, still operating known as Canyon Cliffs. Wow. There was a skydiving simulator. A wind tunnel? Okay. According to Wikipedia, Action Park and its defenders often pointed out that it was one of the first water parks in the nation and thus pioneered ideas that were later widely copied. This meant that visitors were using rides that had not been tested through practical use for very long. Ride designers may have had insufficient training in physics or engineering. They seemed to build rides, one attendee recalled, not knowing how they would work, and then let people on them. All right. Okay. And the vast majority of workers at Action Park regularly seen were teenagers. A security director for the park, Jim Desai, says he got that job at the age of 21 after having worked at the park for 2 years. Most were underaged, undertrained, and often under the influence, and cared little for enforcing park rules and safety requirements. Height and weight-based restrictions were often ignored. The park also sold beer in many kiosks on the grounds, which similarly relaxed enforcement of the drinking age, as with other restrictions in the park. Doctors treating the injured often reported that many of them were intoxicated. So this is a disaster, Action Park. They're only lucky that they're only... How many fatalities? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There were six. There were six fatalities. One heart attack, couple drownings, couple electrocutions, someone hit their head. Or I think. Yeah. The Alpine Slide. Yeah, that's it. Not Alpine. Yeah, the Alpine Slide. Someone hit their head. Tidal Wave Pool electrocution. Tidal Wave Pool drowning. Great. Heart attack. So great. So it's as bad as what you thought it was, and now you have a movie that commemorates it with Johnny Knoxville. So there you go. There you go. Action Park in, I think it's Vernon, New Jersey, and I think it's still around. I think they still have it. I think they at least still have the water park. They also had Alpine Center and Motor World. Yeah, a little go-kart area. You're less likely to get killed riding their go-karts than going in the tidal wave pool. That to me is funny. It's also known as Traction Park. Yes, I heard that as a kid. I did hear that name as a kid. Traction Park, Accident Park, and Class Action Park, which is a really funny name. That's even better than Traction Park. Class Action Park. I don't think there was ever a class action lawsuit, though. Don't think there was ever that. It's now Mountain Creek Water Park. Really? It's not really Action Park anymore? You might as well just capitalize on the whole dangerous theme at this point. You might as well just do that. But no, I never went to it. I went to Beaucraft and Scotch Plains, which I think is still around this summer. And there was also the Land of Make-Believe in Hope, New Jersey. But that was like in a nice area. Beaucraft was off a fucking highway. You can see the cars zoom by at 60 miles an hour while you're doing mini golf and on the little Ferris wheel and playing on the arcade games there. But I love Beaucraft. That was the closest one to me. We couldn't afford to go to Disneyland or Six Flags, even Great Adventure. We couldn't go to Six Flags. We never went to Six Flags. And that was like 45 minutes away. So Beaucraft it was for me. Okay, and finally, this is from at Keeping Up Gaming. Whether it's Battlefield, Star Wars, or Doctor Who, why do you think some men, not all, some men, freak out whenever a woman takes on a lead role in their fandom? Is it misogyny or something else? Now, misogyny is a prejudice against women. That's the definition. I looked it up before. It's not necessarily a hatred, at least, even though hatred is misogyny on some level. But it's at least a prejudice. Okay. Glad Ian's not here. He can bite my head off for my opinions, like he usually would do. This is what I think is going on. With some men, yes. I think they're just so blinded by not wanting their franchise fucked within their eyes that they're going to be pissed off. They're going to be pissed off. It's ruining their world. I Luke Skywalker is the guy I follow. He's my Jedi Knight. Not Rey. Not this Mary Sue. By the way, what the fuck's a Mary Sue still? I never heard that term before, The Force Awakens. What is that? Luke was overpowered as well. Did you fucking see him in Return of the Jedi? Who the fuck did he train with? He trained with Yoda for a week and a half. And then all of a sudden he's doing force chokes and beating that giant fucking monster. Anyway, yeah. Luke was the original Mary Sue. So, okay. So you don't want to paint with too broad a brush. Well, I'll say this. You first of all have to realize that the people that yell online the loudest are usually the most insane. I don't care what the issue is. Sometimes it's justified, but a lot of times it's not. So the people that are going to be upset on social media, that's not the average folk. The average folk don't care. The average folk will forget that, you know, Rey became a Jedi or is the focal point of the new Star Wars trilogy. Most well-adjusted people won't care. Yes, you're going to have some geeks that are going to freak out. Yes. But I don't think it's all just blind misogyny or hatred or prejudice. I don't think that's it. I think that might explain a little bit. I don't think that explains all of it. I think there's some men, and there's women too, that just want to identify with someone that's more like them. This is the best analogy I can give this. And this mentality still pervades today from being a child. So when I grew up, my first favorite action figure franchise before G.I. Joe was He-Man. Brawny, big freaking men. He-Man. It's in the name. You want to be a man, you play with He-Man. That's what you look up for. You want the roided muscles. You want the huge pecs. You want the biceps. You play with He-Man. Now, that's not to say I did not have female figures in that line. I had Teela, and I had Evil Lyn. I don't think I had the Sorceress. They're not the Sorceress. But I had Teela, and I had Evil Lyn. So I had the bad girl with the yellow skin that was jaundiced, Evil Lyn. And then I had, well, I always equated with my sister. I'm not going to get into that why, because she acted like Evil Lyn. And then Teela, good old Teela with the nice legs. Anyway, so it's not like as a boy you wouldn't want to play with girl figures. But that's not like if the line was Teela, I wouldn't have bought it probably, because why would I be identifying or want to role model myself after a woman if I'm a small child? So there was a She-Ra line that was the sister line. Literally the sister line, or cousin line, actually. The cousin. To He-Man. So She-Ra existed. I knew a couple girls on the block that had She-Ra. And as a kid, She-Ra, I looked at it, I was like, yeah, that's cool. I mean, I'm not going to play with She-Ra. Why would I play with the girls' line if I can do the guys' line? I don't identify with She-Ra. I don't identify with the long, glamorous hair and the Wonder Woman type outfit and riding a unicorn. I identify with brawny He-Man and having Battle Cat, you know, and wielding a sword and axe, and that was my guy. So I think that's what's going on here. We're looking at a He-Man She-Ra situation in the modern age. So some people still want to identify with the same franchise or role models that they had growing up, and they can't get over it, that it's might have changed. And that's not to say that these same people, and this is why you don't want to paint with too broad a brush, because the same people that might hate the idea of Rey as a protagonist, they might also really like the Aliens franchise with Ripley. They might also like Tomb Raider. So it's not necessarily that they hate all women in the protagonist role. It might just be that it's upsetting their personal apple cart. It's changing their franchise too much for their comfort zone. And I'm not just saying that's justified. They're being babies to me either way. But I'm just trying to say, I think that's what's going on in some of these cases. Not all. There are some people that just don't want to, a woman, they feel like invading their man world. I absolutely see that point. But I don't think you cannot describe that as every single person has a problem with it. You can't say that every single person that doesn't like a female Doctor Who is because they're a misogynist. I think that's unfair to everyone. I think it describes some people, but not all. And it's dangerous to generalize about a fandom's entire personality. I don't think you whittle that down. Now, Doctor Who is, to me, different just because, to me, that's a very more traditional, over 50-year-old franchise where it just happened to be a man every single time. But I don't think there's ever a rule saying it would have to be a man every single time. So, for example, for the new Doctor Who, I saw a little bit of people complain, but I really didn't see that much of it, at least in my eyes, because that's an alien character to begin with, and they regenerate and always look different. So for me, that wasn't a huge deal in terms of, like, I personally am not a huge Doctor Who fan, so I don't care who becomes Doctor Who. I mean, I watched some of them, but I still don't know what the hell the big deal is about Doctor Who. I just never got the show. But having a woman Doctor Who, to me, that's not like a major change, because to me, that's not a written part of the character. That has to be a man. Now, something entirely different would be if they made James Bond a woman. James Bond's a written character that's been written in a series of novels where he's a British officer, a royal officer in the Navy. That's who he is. That's who he's always been. If they just went off that and changed that, then okay, I got a problem. There's an established, this is who the character is. This is how he's written. This is how he is. That I'd have a problem with. Actually, I don't think they'd ever make I guess they could do a sister James Bond. They did James Bond Jr. I couldn't even bring myself to watch James Bond Jr., for example. That's a whole different conversation. I thought that was stupid. But I think for Doctor Who, it's an alien character. It's like, who cares? But for a well-written, established character of the past 50 years, I think more people have a problem with that. But in terms of changing up the franchise, that's different. So like having Rey come in, for example, or having a woman be on the cover of Battlefield or part of the group, I just think some people are being babies. Absolutely. Some people just don't prefer to identify their hero or protagonist character with something that they're not. But they're the ones missing out, though, because there's brilliant character arcs, and you can have the same drama, same action and emotion with a female character, obviously, as with a male character, action character. Either way, you can learn the same stuff. You go through the same emotional changes and range. So yeah, there's immaturity as well. I'll just say that. I think there's a lot of immaturity. I will say that versus saying everyone's being straight out misogynist. I will say they're definitely being immature. But where does the immaturity come from? And I think it comes down to role models and familiarity and not wanting to look up, having their franchise change so much so that now they're having to identify with someone of another gender. And that's their issue. And I think that's what's going on with some, but then again, I can't psychoanalyze an entire group of fandom. It's tough to do that. With Star Wars, people loved Princess Leia. They always loved Princess Leia. But yeah, I think it's the fact that you now have like a sort of a female Luke Skywalker. That's what bothered some people, because that's not what they were used to. I think. Then again, people that just yell online, yell the loudest, and that's the minority of people either way that are just yelling online about fucking geek shit that doesn't matter in the long run. That's what it comes down to. Speaking of shit that doesn't matter, thanks so much for listening to this Not So Common podcast. Again, I'll be at Too Many Games June 22nd to June 24th. Thanks to my new sponsor, NordVPN, coming on board. And thanks to Stamps.com as well. And remember, there's also Dollar Shave Club. Go to dollarshaveclub.com/Pat. And you can get a nice razor for $1, free shipping. No commitment, cancel any time. Get the executive razor, which is over there somewhere. Where is it? Where's my Dollar Shave Club razor? Remember to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play, YouTube, wherever you listen to this. Please share the podcast. Let others know how much you enjoyed it. Finally, if you want to follow me, and you can follow me on Twitter at PatTheNESPunk. And if you want to help support me in my endeavors here and abroad, not abroad, I'm just doing it in San Diego. But if you want to help support me, please check out my Patreon at patreon.com/PatContry. Thanks, everyone. I'll see you next time. Hopefully not screwing up my initial recording and having to redo it, because that wasn't fun.